it's a pleasure to be able to talk to you a little bit about Dr. Vogel. I'm at Washington State University. I work for the USDA, and my two co-authors, Aaron Carter and Bob Allen, between the three of us, at least we have all of the remaining papers and inventory that Dr. Vogel left and a good deal of his germplasm, so we feel like we owe him a great legacy. And also at Washington State, I think we say the word Vogel at least four or five times a day. Our building is named after him, and as are two research funds, an endowed chair, and of course all our threshers. So I had one graduate student who used it as a verb. She asked me when we were going to go out Vogeling. So now, how do I make these change? I got the title of this talk from Bob Allen. This is a quote of his, and I'll just let you read it for a minute. And I think that this quote really captures the spirit of Orville, who I actually never met, but who I have read a good deal about, because he spent a lot of time looking at wheat plants and fighting for lodging resistance. And this is a photo of Orville with Gaines wheat when it was released in 1962. It was the first commercial variety that contained the reduced height genes from Norin 10, and Bob Allen with Omar, which is the wheat that it replaced. And Omar actually was another of Vogel's releases. It was a breakthrough when it was released because it contained resistance to several races of bunt and dwarf bunt, and also very good milling characteristics. So Vogel was the USDA wheat breeder at Pullman from 1931 to 1973. He was born in Nebraska, and got his BA and MS at University of Nebraska, and then came up to work for Gaines at Washington State, and got his PhD working on shattering in wheat. Back then, a lot of the varieties that were grown were Turkey Red and selections out of Turkey Red. And his PhD project was to look at bloom strength and how it affected shattering. And he spent a lot of time cutting blooms off of wheat and measuring their thickness. So I gave him a lot of credit for persistence. He married Bertha Berkman in 1931, and he died in 1991. And I want to switch to Norin 10 because it's probably one of the things he's most famous for. Dr. Salmon, who was a USDA agronomist assigned to MacArthur, the Army of Occupation, noticed that the Japanese were growing a lot of these shorter wheats under irrigation, and he liked the way they looked. So he brought several of them over to the U.S., and he sent them over here in 1946, and they were grown under quarantine, and one of those was Norin 10. And as you can see, Norin 10 has turkey in the pedigree as well. Various people call Norin 10 a winter wheat or a spring wheat. I think it's probably somewhat facultative. And then those wheats were sent out to other locations for testing. And so Vogel first looked at it in the spring of 1948, and it was planted at Spillman Farm. And then as he noticed, Norin 10 appeared to be susceptible to every important plant disease in the Pacific Northwest. It had a lot of male sterility when grown at Pullman. It had brittle rachis, it shattered badly, and working with it was going to take a lot of effort. And I think a lot of people don't, I certainly didn't realize it until I started putting together this talk, what a dog Norin 10 really was. So the fact that he decided to work with it and as much as he did, I think, owes a lot to his vision for a certain type of plant type that he was looking for. He coined the term semi-dwarf. This is a field book page from 1950, and on the right it says the medium short ones are much better than the very short ones. Norrington actually has two genes for dwarfing, known as RHT1 and RHT2, or under the new nomenclature RHTD1 and RHTB1. And we know now that they're analogs of the Arabidopsis gibberellic acid insensitivity locus. They're actually Della proteins, if anybody is up on the gibberellic acid pathway. And if you get both of them in a variety, it's very short, and it's just too short for our environment. So semi-dwarf meant that you had one or the other. And I'm not sure if you can see this, but this is the field book from 1952 where he actually designated selection 14 out of this set. These crosses were first made in 1949 by Dick Namagitsu, who was a technician at the USDA, and there were four crosses that they got good seed off of, and Norrington was always used as the female because of the male sterility. So in this one, you can see the one thing I have circled is that he said he made crosses off of it. This is an F3 progeny row that he turned around and made crosses off of. And then also over on the one side, they did a lot of testing of these F3 progeny rows. That was his breeding style. And he estimates that he gets 100 bushels per acre off this one, whereas everything else in this list, it's about 80 bushels. So he picked the highest yielding, most agronomically suitable one. And then he shared that with Borlaug at that same time. And I picked these two pictures of Borlaug. The one on the upper left is from 1943, when he first had some lines with stem rust resistance that he wanted to publicize. And the one on the right, you can see the weed is much, much shorter. So it was a completely different plant type. And then the two of them are together at a conference in Oregon in the newspaper photo. So it was that selection 14, that cross with Brever, that got shared. We have a major problem in the Pacific Northwest. This photo was just taken a couple years ago, and it's soil erosion. And I think few people realize that Vogel wasn't actually trying to increase yields. He was trying to yield per se. He was trying to come up with a solution for soil erosion. And his concept was that if they could shorten the height of the wheat, it could be planted earlier in the fall, and you could get a good stand in the field that would be more competitive with the weeds. The wheat then also had to have, it must not lodge. What was going on before that is they were planting these taller wheats very early, and the plants were just getting too big. And later in the season, there was a lot of lodging. It had to have disease resistance, and it also had to have high milling and baking quality. And I think most breeders can sympathize when you read Orville's notes over the years, his disagreements with the milling and baking industry over whether or not a wheat variety was suitable for production. And that's been going on for quite a while, I guess. And he also pioneered several breeding methods that now are in fairly common use, but back then they were considered to be fairly radical for a self-pollinated crop like wheat. So recurrent selection, I mentioned that he had made crosses on an F3 progeny row of Norrington. This was a very he did this all the time. In this photo, Orville's on the left, and Swenson, who was another ARS wheat breeder assigned to Pullman, is on the right. And he actually got in a lot of trouble for using this breeding strategy. ARS administration wanted him to use a back cross breeding strategy and back cross single genes for bunt resistance in, and he kept doing recurrent selection and making complex crosses. The other thing he tried a lot, although he never exported it, was the use of male sterility and hybrid wheat. He looked at a lot of different, you go back through the field books and you see a lot of male sterile experiments. And in this case, what he was doing was using the male sterility out of Norrin 10 in what he called natural crosses. He'd plant Norrin 10 and then he'd surround it with the line he wanted it to cross to see if he could exploit that in a recurrent selection type he didn't find enough heterosis to pursue it though. And he also pioneered resistance breeding methods in wheat. And this is another thing we think of as fairly common now, but in the 1940s it really wasn't. He realized that if he selected, he was most of his career from 1931 up until the 50s was concentrated on selecting for resistance to bunt and smut. The Pacific Northwest, especially the area around Spokane, at one time was known as the smut capital of the world. And it's because we have a lot of the Tillandsia fungi that cause bunt and smut survive in the soil in the Pacific Northwest as well as on the seed. And so we would get constant epidemics all the time. Back in the 1920s, threshers would explode during harvest. We have pictures of combines exploding in the 50s before they got this under control. And so there had been some major genes identified for resistance that they worked with in the 30s, and then the major genes would break down. And Orville started realizing that if he constantly selected for minor gene resistance, very small amounts of resistance, and then combined those from different sources, he could come up with resistance that was more durable. And the first line that was the result of that effort was Brevor. It was released in the late 40s. It didn't gain a lot of public acceptance initially because it didn't mill very well. The millers would complain that it was a woolly miller, and so they blackballed it. But it was its bunt resistance held up until probably just recently, actually. He also did this with stripe rust, and stripe rust at the time actually wasn't that much of a problem until later in his career it became a severe problem, I think probably because of the increased use of nitrogen. And as you can see, this photo for stripe rust on the bottom is taken off our spreader rows this year, and we still get a lot of stripe rust in the Pacific Northwest. So we actually had our worst epidemic in about 20 years just this year. So. And then he worked a lot on eye spots or straw break or foot rot, which is a rot disease that causes a lot of lodging as well. These are the lines that he released, and the newspaper shows you a photo of Brevor, which is the lax one, and Elmar, which is the club wheat. Club wheat at the time occupied about 75% of the acreage in the Pacific Northwest. Sorry, that's reminding me to speed up. And then one thing he said is that never personally become protective of a variety. And just for example, Omar was released in 1955. It was on major acreage in 1958, and in 1961, stripe rust took it out. Luckily, he had gains ready to go at that point. And there are still farmers around the Pacific Northwest that remember that time in the 1960s when they first got a hold of gains. And they kind of harvested quietly because the yields were so high they weren't sure that they should talk to each other about them. So. And then as Borlaug said, he never rested. And I think in a lot of ways, in addition to the semi-dwarfs, his work with equipment has had as much of an effect on world food production. He designed and invented new gadgets, as he called them. And this is Bill's welding shop in Pullman. It's still in existence. And Chuck Bill Gerheiser, who was a good friend of Vogel's, I think, and helped him with the designs of a lot of his equipment. This is a small thresher that Bill's standing next to. And so planters, the one on the in the color picture is a very early planter that he invented in the 30s. And then the other planter was invented basically to plant hedgerows. And I think it's significant that the one on the bottom has a cover on it. It's so that people could sit in there and plant wheat in any kind of weather condition, because for him that was important. And then, of course, the threshers. The one is obviously a historical picture, and on the bottom, I took this outside our barn about 3 years ago when we were all lined up for harvest. And the one in the upper right-hand corner is my thresher. It's actually one of the original ones that Vogel designed. And this year we put a new motor on it finally, and we painted it blue, red, white, and blue now. We thought that was appropriate. And a few years ago, Bill's Welding lost the plans to the thresher, and they came up and got this one and took it down there and took it all apart, telling me that they were fixing it up, and they made new plans off of it. So. And then, of course, the combine. And the combine was actually a dream of his, the small plot combines. He built the combine after he had retired. He finally had time to work on it. And we found a letter from Rod Bertramson, who was the department chair, saying to Orville, "I see you finally got your plot combine, and you were characteristically over budget." And now Bill Gerheiser had to bail him out. And then on a personal note, when I was an undergrad, a freshman at Colorado State, the wheat breeder there, Jim Welsh, was talking about this guy up in Washington who really was going to advance wheat breeding with these new plot combines. So we still have the original combine, too. So I'm about done. What I wanted to point out that leads us into the future, one thing that Vogel worked hard on was breeding for ecological conditions. This is a typical Palouse landscape, and he recognized the value of looking at various hazards and very real things that go on in production. These are my foot rot hedgerows from a couple years ago. We still do the same thing in hedgerow format, and the susceptible line, of course, is flat, completely flat, and a lot of the reason why so much of my material is standing is because of what I inherited from Vogel and Bob Allen. I'm gonna skip that one. He consulted in Turkey and Australia in the 1960s, this is from the Lewiston Tribune. We're in a really small place, so the fact that Orville was known abroad was newsworthy. And as Borlaug said about Orville, He blazed new scientific paths for us. They were good friends. I think they shared a streak of stubbornness that made them look at things about the same way. His list of awards is fairly long, I think significantly, though, they didn't start to come in until about the 60s because maybe this stubborn streak, it got him into trouble early on. And the semi-dwarf wheats increased yields in Washington by 20%. And we're talking about going from average yields of about 46 bushels per acre when they started up to about 60 bushels per acre in the late 60s. Now, a lot of that was because they could put more nitrogen on at the same time. So it was this whole production system. Gains and new gains were cultivars. Selection 101 was another selection, and it was given used a lot in the Oregon program, and then again at Simmet as well. These wheats, though, caused new problems, and when you read things that Orville wrote, you see every time they solved one problem, it caused another issue. And one of the problems is that the coleopsils are also shortened in the wheats, so they emerge poorly from deep seeding. We seed typically about 5 inches below the soil surface, and it's probably one of the last places where we have a lot of bare, fallow soil. And not that I think that's good, it's just the way it's done right now. And so a lot of the latter part of his career and most of Bob Allen's career has been spent on working on improving the emergence. We still have a long way to go on that. So the lessons learned, I think, that are really real legacy are love and know the organism you work with, plants grow in soil. By that, I mean it's an ecological system, and we can't just look at the wheat plant. We have to look at the whole thing. Use cutting-edge tools, or if you don't have them, invent them. And this is a quote from Borlaug noting something that Orville was good at, persisting in the face of ultra-conservative, ultra-sophisticated peers and superiors. And then finally, the critical role of farmers. And actually, that helped him out. When he got in trouble with his administrators, the farmers would go bail him out. So for the future, I think we can take a lot of what he did and a lot of what his approach was and try and figure out where we're going with climate change, likely lower availability of fertilizer and inputs, the need for additional soil conservation, and use some of these approaches for breeding. So thanks very much, and I'll take any questions that you have. Yeah, actually, Brevor was one of his first attempts at a shorter wheat, and the reason he crossed Norinton to Brevor was he was trying to combine these genes in Norinton with Brevor's already fairly short, stiff straw. Okay, thank you.